Welcome to the Intersectionality Lab, a fair space to explore intersections.
Hello, I'm Almina and Inga is hosting with me today. Also joining us for this episode is David Almeida. To give a brief introduction of our guest, David is originally from Portugal and he is currently working in scientific software development for a climate change program at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Austria. He brings a unique bachelor's in cell and molecular biology and a master's in data science. Upon finishing his studies, he joined the Portuguese chapter of Transparency International, which is a global network of anti-corruption NGOs. And it's also very important to mention his former position as the president of the board at He for She Lisboa. He's been an activist for over 8 years with a particular focus on gender equality and anti-discrimination. So it's evident that David is very passionate about social justice, sustainability, as well as civic participation. And we're very excited to have him here today to share his insights and expertise on today's topic, toxic masculinity. So hello, David, and welcome to a new episode.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us once again. It's a pleasure to have you. So we can just dive into the topic. So toxic masculinity, it's a concept we hear a lot. So it's important to define it and talk about it more clearly. So what would you say that toxic masculinity actually is?
Yes. Once again, thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to discuss these very poignant topics. So starting from the basics, or maybe for some not so basics. So toxic masculinity, for us to really understand the concept, we have to take a few steps back and understand the idea of gender, right? The concept of gender, which is separate from the concept and the idea of sex, right? So gender is a specifically and especially a social concept. It is something determined in society by many different factors, be they historical, cultural, etc. Whereas sex tends to be associated with our biology. You know, the biological reality and the physiological features of our bodies determine the sex that we are assigned at birth and the sexual characteristics that we end up developing as we grow. So for gender, in many Western societies, especially post-colonialism, gender has been defined especially as a binary concept where there are male people and female people, right? The masculine gender and the feminine gender. And of course, many of us that live, especially in the global north and Western countries, have a very good awareness of what these concepts tend to encompass. So male and female characteristics for gender are typically diametrically opposed, right? What is masculine tends to not be feminine, and people from either gender are expected not to particularly associate or incorporate features of a different gender in their behavior and in their person. So when we talk about toxic masculinity, really what we're talking about is a manifestation of the features of masculinity, of the male gender, of the masculine, to a degree that is considered, in fact, toxic by society. So what we tend to associate with masculinity, I think, is pretty evident for many of us. Men are expected to be, the breadwinners in families, are considered to be the stronger sex or the stronger gender, are supposed to be less emotional and more rational. And of course, a lot of these characteristics are expected of the gender, regardless of them being true or not, of the particular person, the individual, or just of the gender altogether, right? We understand that gender construction also ends up developing stereotypes, and these stereotypes become very harmful for populations in general. But and on the individual level, of course, people develop expectations of the roles that they should occupy in society, and whether or not they can fulfill them is determinant of how they feel about themselves. So in many ways, gender and toxic masculinity specifically is also a side effect of the feeling that they must belong and must subscribe to a certain norm of their gender to the point where it becomes unhealthy. So examples of why masculinity can be unhealthy, of course, you know, there's nothing wrong with men defining themselves individually or as a group as masculine people. You can have many interpretations of that, but you can be stereotypically masculine. You can be someone that, you know, cares about their physical fitness and tries to be very muscular. You can be someone that maybe doesn't show off emotions too much, as long as you know how to manage them in other ways. You can strive to be a breadwinner. There is nothing inherently wrong with any of those characteristics. The problem becomes toxic when it becomes damaging not only to the person internally, but especially when it is projected outwardly and becomes a damage to the common good, you know. And I think that's what we especially see with toxic masculinity. We talk about in much more, now giving more contemporary examples, you know, of men and their behavior online, the harassment that they practice in public spaces, sometimes even, you know, things like hooliganism, you know, football fans and sports fans showing this community behavior of being, reckless disturbers of the peace. Of course, things such as sexual violence and sexual harassment can be manifestations of toxic masculinity, because we know that men are expected to be sexual, are expected to be virile, are expected in many ways to view women and as sexual objects and not as full people. And so, of course, from that, you have to derive the idea that they are usable. And if they are usable, you lead to cases of harassment and violence. Of course, domestic violence is one of the biggest plagues that faces societies across the world, and is, of course, very tied to these misogynistic tropes and these expectations of men as the leaders of the household. And again, the lack of expression of emotions is really damaging, because it leads to, again, toxic outbursts of displays of these boiled up emotions, which could have possibly been expressed in healthy ways to deconstruct what is happening, but instead exploded into very harmful practices. So, you know, circling around all of this, I would say that is what toxic masculinity can be.
Mm-hmm. And you already touched it, like how toxic masculinity can affect women and also, of course, a bit the LGBTQ community. But maybe can you specify a bit more how the concept of toxic masculinity affect other genders than men?
Yeah,
or I mean, masculinity.
For sure. So I guess it comes really deep down. It comes from just the, you know, we all subscribe to gender roles and gender norms to some extent in society. And of course, there is always a trade-off with that. It tends to correspond to a certain level of social acceptance, the fact that we accept these roles and norms and we practice them collectively, but also comes to a certain degree of personal sacrifice, because we probably most likely, or maybe for some definitely, do not correspond 100% to the expectations of gender. In fact, it's sometimes very difficult to know what the expectation of gender is, because it is a very difficult sometimes concept to grasp concretely, right? These things are also evolving over time, you know. Why do we associate pink and blue with a certain gender? Historically, it was known that, for example, some centuries ago in France, you would have expected the opposite of what we maybe associate today. So sometimes it's tricky. But why does it affect other people? Well, because when we talk specifically about toxic masculinity, we could explore ideas like toxic femininity. But I would argue, for example, that the effects of gender norms in women are perhaps more tend to affect women more internally than necessarily people externally, and at least not in visible and violent ways as men. And we can also sort of agree with that in terms of the statistics. But in general, toxic masculinity becomes harmful precisely because of these factors, right? When we raise generations of men to understand that their emotions are not a priority in their development, when in effect we are stunting them from learning how to be emotionally intelligent, from learning how to handle emotions, not only speaking them out to others and explaining what they are feeling, but even to themselves, right? They do not learn the tools to understand understand what they are feeling and whether the feeling that they are feeling is something that they should, you know, go through, express to someone, share. So when we don't equip young men and boys with these tools to understand their emotions and feelings, it's natural that they grow up in a certain way stunted. And again, the expression of those feelings ends up being very limited in nature, in scope, and in the context that is allowed, right? Even socially, we don't expect men, I mean, perhaps some of us would appreciate it, but in general, society is very much against the idea that men can express themselves in the same way that women do, right? Either because they will face backlash for, you know, looking feminine, being overly emotional, simply not subscribing to the idea that we expect of a stereotypical man. And because of that, we have specific contexts in which it is, in fact, acceptable for men to express emotion, but in a very limited range of them, right? Again, I bring the idea of like a hooligan in the sports community, right? We expect men to be very passionate about watching a football match or a games, some sort of sport event. And it's perfectly normal for men to, you know, show, in fact, a hyper emotion, but it's also a very limited type of emotions, right? You either show yourself extremely happy about the success of your team or the game, you feel angry towards the rival team. And so in that sense, you feel permitted to act on the emotions that you didn't have permission to act on in other contexts. And so it's natural that other things overflow into that space. And not only might you show your true emotions about the game that you just saw, but you might also release frustration about your job or your relationships or just other aspects of your life, because you can finally have a space where you can showcase them. Again, the stereotypes and looking at how it affects other people, because men are expected to have certain characteristics to them, being masculine, virile, it is natural for them to also act against those that do not fall into those aspects, because masculinity also expects men to assert themselves as masculine by rejecting what isn't, right? So again, we talk about the LGBT community here, right? We see homophobic attacks because it is important to distance yourself from anything that might be perceived as not heterosexual, as minimally queer, because that is not a masculine trait. And in fact, it almost threatens your masculinity if you are associated with those ideas. And so naturally, you feel like you have to go against it. The harm on women is perhaps the most evident, of course, the violence against women. In fact, the violence against lesbian women is very prevalent and very high, precisely because, you know, lesbian women might be the fraction of the population that tends to least necessitate interaction with men, and or at least in a relationship context, lesbian women are not interested in being in a relationship with cisgender, heterosexual or not men. And so naturally, it is also a certain, not a threat perhaps, but, you know, a point of contention where, you know, the masculinity of the man doesn't matter because it is just a complete non-interest on the other side. So yeah, there are many, many ways in which this happens. And importantly, it doesn't happen by just the actions of an individual. It is also a collective practice, right? Other men enable and facilitate the behavior, the toxic behavior that men participate in. We are just following now the conclusions of a huge scandal in France regarding a sexual crime perpetrated by the husband of a lady, Gisèle Pelicot. And it shows that, you know, not only is it an unspeakable amount of abuse, but it shows precisely the pattern of men covering each other's backs in the practice of a completely heinous crime. And that tends to be one of the key starting points to actually making a change and asking men to help. It is to not allow them to stay silent in the face of discrimination, in the face of abuse, to be the first to break the chain and say, no, that is not correct. Because it masculinity asks of men to be, well, to use an expression that isn't very politically correct, the stereotypical bros before hoes is very much alive in masculinity, and it needs to be critically assessed to, in fact, make things better for everyone.
Yeah, that's a really great explanation, and you tackled upon so many different aspects, like the emotional aspect and emotional intelligence, and then also relationships, and it also mental health, right? You talked about how they're less likely also to seek mental health and care about that, and then also just their priorities and way of expressing themselves. You also mentioned young boys, which I think I would like us to focus on now. So young boys have so many role models, right, who might reiterate this idea of what masculinity is and what boys should be. So I'm wondering what you think about this concept in today's world. So this concept has been around already for like some 40 years, and there's been more and more research on it. And now with more research on it, but also more influencers on social media, more access to the internet where people who aren't qualified to speak about some things can speak about those things freely and express themselves however they'd like. They have a lot of influence on boys, right? So we can see evidently that it is having a negative, that it's negatively impacting them as well. So what are your thoughts on this, about these influencers and people online promoting toxic masculinity?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's one that I also think about all the time. I'm particularly interested nowadays in the digital and online space in regards to questions of just all around social justice and how it's shaping things. I think for before answering more towards your question, I think it's just a space that is not only in many ways difficult to research because of just the nature of how it is organized. You know, the internet is different for everyone, unfortunately, nowadays. So we can't have, you know, an idea of what other people are looking at just because we know what we see in our devices. And platforms themselves are not very friendly towards being looked inside transparently for us to really understand what's going on under the hood. But it is critical. I think maybe 10, 15 years ago, we could have questioned if things that happen online have any impact in real life. But I think nowadays it's undeniable. And in fact, for people that are perhaps like myself that consider themselves to be sort of critically online, it's very obvious that trends and things that started very small a few years ago are now very mainstream, not only online, but have bled into mainstream politics. You know, we discuss things in world-changing events in politics all around the globe that started online, and you can trace those things. And there are people that do that kind of research, which is very interesting. So yes, looking at how young boys and men navigate the online space is critical to understand how it works, because at least in my generation, I grew up with smartphones only after quite a few number of years. And so I had a childhood free of those kinds of devices. But nowadays, it's to be expected that young boys and men have an exposure to screens and to the online space from a very early age, which in general, there's also just a lot of questions around what that does to any person, regardless of gender, regardless of what they are exposed to. What is the impact of smartphones and the online exposure from such an early age? But especially knowing what the content exists in these platforms, we can definitely start looking at some challenges, but also perhaps some opportunities, right? So we definitely know that a lot of platforms work primarily using recommendation algorithms. You know, nowadays they might use terms like AI to describe it, but these things have been around longer than what we nowadays like to throw the AI label on everything, right? These recommendation algorithms just create a profile of you as a user, and they determine the content that you are most likely to watch for longer, because platforms need to keep you longer watching to feed you ads so that they can profit. That's the business model of the major platforms that we have nowadays: social media, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, Twitter, or X. These are all similar models of functioning. Of course, they have different designs, but in essence, that is what is necessary. And over the years, we've come to understand that platforms promote reactionary content, content that engages in questionable discourse, but content that especially brings out reactions from people. because that is what platforms need to keep them engaged and hooked in their space. And that with that comes naturally understanding which type of content elicits more reactions from the public. And it has been pretty clear that publications and content from right-wing leaning organizations, but especially from reactionary right-wing spaces, populist right-wing spaces, you know, questionable practices and ideologies like what we typically refer to as the manosphere, right? This set of spaces online where especially men engage in almost a subculture in some ways and an ideology that creates a completely different worldview where, you know, there is a very clear, even more so than in contemporary daily life, a very rigid belief of men as the top of the social hierarchy, many strict rules on how men should be, what men should do to maximize, you know, their role as men, almost cult-like behaviors in some aspects of, you know, things that they should do to improve their appearance, to be successful in having a relationship. But of course, we are also not talking about necessarily a healthy relationship because they expect submission to them. And so, of course, a few years ago, we could say that these were niche communities where people engaged in these strange meme culture. But nowadays, it's become apparent that it's something that has spread to many spaces. You know, the vice president or the vice president elect of the United States, J.D. Vance, is someone that, at least from many news outlets, there are suspicions that he is someone that is very familiar with those kinds of online spaces. So we will have soon in the government of the United States, the second in command being someone that is very much engaged in these extremist practices. And of course, young men and boys, when they grow up in online spaces, when we socialize, at least in person, we have immediate feedback mechanisms to teach us what is right and what is wrong, right? We see people's reactions. We might be scolded. The consensus of the group might be against our personal opinion. And so we sort of fine-tune the way that we behave and the way that we think based on people's reactions to what we do, right? That's socializing in a nutshell. And that's especially growing up young and learning what is right from what is wrong. We also have parents that teach us those kinds of things, school teachers, all of these environments. The online space doesn't have that sort of moderation, right? The online space is curated for your experience and your experience only. The online space doesn't have necessarily people telling you what is right or what is wrong. That you might have a lot of people that disagree with you, but engagement online with other people tends to be very short-lived and very aggressive. You know, comment sections are not necessarily always the space for debate, or at least not for nuanced debate. It tends to be much more a fighting match where each person tries to assert that their position is the better one for the sake of showing that it is the better one, not for the sake of intellectual honesty or reaching a consensus or a conclusion that, you know, might change your point of view. I'm not saying that those things don't happen, but that's not necessarily how those platforms are designed to work. And so when we grow up here, I speculate, of course, when we grow up in these sorts of spaces, it's only expected that you are not going to be developing yourself as a person with opinions that will differ very much from the communities that you interact with, right? I mean, not to say that this doesn't happen in real life. Of course, it does. We all assimilate the culture and the communities that we live in, but we tend to have more ways of critically assessing those things in real life versus online, where you might very quickly go into these very radical beliefs without any sort of showcase that not only are those beliefs radical compared to the majority of other ideas, but you will have no one questioning your beliefs there. They will incentivize you to seek them out further. And in the offline space, other people will not know that you are engaging with these ideas, right? It's the aspect of the anonymity online and the secrecy. It's your little bubble that no one really can look into unless you actively share it with them or they have some sort of access to your accounts if you're a parent. So yes, it becomes very difficult to have control or to at least foster good types of role models and good types of lessons to take from the online space when it is so difficult to restrict the way children and young people access these spaces. So there needs to be, and platforms don't really have a big effort on their end on preventing these kinds of things, right? At the end of the day, they have numbers that they present in financial reports that will definitely boost their numbers with their shareholders and make their stock price go up, and, you know, instituting better moderation and better regulation around the content that exists, the people that can access it, is only creating, barriers to access to the platform that will perhaps, at the end of the day, negatively impact their numbers. So they don't have a big incentive on their end to do anything. So it is up to us as consumers, as citizens, as people that participate in these spaces to make those demands of policymakers and of platforms to be able to change it. And there are good examples, right? I mean, yes, we talk about the Manosphere. We talk about how there are so many influencers that are, you know, negatively impacting the way young boys especially perceive the world, how they diminish the role of women and the importance of women in society, how they promote, you know, even grifts and scams, you know, young kids being hooked into betting websites and casinos online because those are the business models that tend to also sponsor these kinds of creators. But there are good examples. I would name, for example, a creator that I myself follow and that I find has very interesting discourse on this question. His name is Hassan Piker. He is a left-wing content creator. He mainly focuses on making left-wing analysis of news. But besides the fact that he is politically left-wing, I think he shows a very interesting example of how we can foster a sort of positive masculinity, right? You would look at Hassan and you would always expect him to be a stereotypical male person, the way he presents himself, the way he behaves. But he is very good at showing what an emotionally aware, emotionally intelligent, and critically evaluating man can be in many, many aspects. And he has the stated goal of trying to promote those kinds of spaces online to guarantee that, you know, when young kids get into these platforms, they are not only exposed to that content, which is very profitable for the platform, but highly, highly damaging to the young kids, but that they can also find spaces where they can maybe start from. Or if they eventually end exposed to that kind of content, maybe are de-radicalized from the ideas that they may have erroneously subscribed to in the past.
And I think you already started to go in a really important direction of how to get active and how to change or stepping out of also, for example, toxic masculinity, socialization and how we grew up with. And I mean, you were president for He for She, and maybe, which is also very impactful movement worldwide, and maybe you can give some examples, because I think this is also a very good example of stepping out of this gender roles and going into action. And maybe you can share some goals of the movement and your experience there.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely in the name the idea that the He for She movement is trying to bring men into the fold of the gender equality conversation in the movement, right? And I've been reflecting more and more recently on this question, because I think in fact, for me, it might be a very critical, pivotal change in perhaps a new wave of feminism. Not that I am personally responsible towards determining historically when the new wave of feminism, if a new wave of feminism is taking place. But I do think that if we are on a new generation and a new time of social justice movements, that there is a critical question that we have to face, especially when we talk about feminism and gender equality, which is the participation of men in the movement. I think what we have seen now in global politics is that, in fact, there's been a high amount of backlash towards the conquests and the success successes of the feminism of the last few decades. The achievements that we have made in sexual reproduction rights, in women's emancipation in the workspace, in, LGBT rights, which are in many ways spearheaded by women in a lot of contexts. All of those things are now being threatened by reactionary politics in ways that are really gaining traction and that may actually nullify a lot of those advancements in very significant ways. So it is a sad reminder that, you know, any person that participates in activism has in present in their mind or should have, which is that, you know, advances are not set in stone. We are always working towards maintaining the rights that we have because we live fundamentally in a sadly discriminatory society, right? We don't live in a society where everyone's lives and everyone's role is valued equally, and eventually there will be pushback. So a lot of us have to actively work towards maintaining and holding the ground that we have conquered in the past. And now we are seeing it with these reactionary politics. And what I want to argue here is that I think, despite the many successes of the feminist movement, which I, of course, applaud all of the brave fighters that have, perhaps I wouldn't like to use the word fighters because it's also very coded in a violent language, which I would like to avoid. But, you know, the brave people that have achieved all of these great wins for humanity as a whole, really. One of the things that wasn't achieved, and I think there are many factors that involve it, I'm not, you know, pointing fingers and blaming people, is that, you know, even in all of these decades of women's emancipation, there has been a consistently low participation of men in the movement. I would say the first obvious factor towards it is that, of course, men are the privileged side in the conversation. So, of course, they have little to no stakes in participating, or they assume they have little to no stakes in participating in the fight for equality. Because for perhaps, you know, a good number of men, it would mean actually losing privileges in guaranteeing equality for all. But of course, I think all of us agree that it would be a net positive for everyone at the end, because we are not just talking about, you know, bringing women up. We're not necessarily talking about bringing men down. We are talking about making things a level playing field and actually, I think, liberating men in many ways, right? I mean, we are talking about allowing positive masculinities to exist, allowing men to not live in a bubble of what is expected of them as people, to live their humanity fully as any other person should. And so it is a liberatory movement for men as well. That is what the he for she movement also tries to embody and tries to promote. But it is indeed a big challenge, which I myself am trying to understand how to do in trying to bring men along with it. I think the fact that men haven't participated in the movement has led to a lot of them not connecting with perhaps the message of the movement, not connecting to how many stakes they actually have in it being successful and how liberatory it can be for them. And ultimately, it's again, when we talk about representation matters, I think representation matters here as well, right? If we have a movement that is led primarily by women, which of course makes sense historically, the one potential disadvantage of it is that it's harder to communicate with the male counterpart and, you know, speak in a way that actually targets the stakes that they have in this fight as well, and to make them understand why they should be participating. So that's something that I'm trying to learn myself, how to best communicate these questions with men and making them understand that they need to participate if they say that they care about these things. And again, promote the maybe take it in reverse, and the attitude of men protecting each other's backs should now become one where men call each other towards the fight to be part of it and to actively participate in it. I think there are lots of interesting projects happening, especially connecting to men and masculinities. A lot of them happen, in fact, in the places where we could say that, you know, we see the ultimate penalty that men receive for showcasing their toxic masculinity, right? We talk about youth detention centers, prisons, and in those spaces, we see very interesting projects from feminist men and feminist people developing these courses or these experiences where people that are in prison or in less favorable social settings are able to learn how, you know, the situation that they can find themselves in might be related to the way that they are, you know, socially programmed to expect to be a certain type of gender or subscribe to certain types of stereotypes. And that in breaking those things, they are not only liberating themselves, but they are also breaking a cycle of violence and perhaps breaking a cycle of, social discrimination and, fragility in the economical sense. In that way, bring men into the fold and make them active creators of the movement. I think that's necessary because, again, the backlash that we are seeing in politics reflects in some part, at least in my opinion, the disconnect that is the gap that has widened in men not understanding why these movements are necessary for them and feeling above all threatened by them instead of actually supportive of
them. That's really interesting. So I think you brought a lot of awareness to so many issues like homophobia and feminism and so on, and also the values that people have and how they don't see it as an issue and the lack of motivation to actually do something. So I think that the he for she movement is huge, and it wants to make changes, but of course with topics that are connected to social justice, it's hard, and there are baby steps to get there because of all these differing opinions. So speaking of your experience in He for She Lishba, what are some impacts that you have seen on your work, even if they are the smallest or maybe even some bigger ones? Which are you the most proud of? Can you share some particular situations?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I definitely do not underestimate the impact of a small, like you said, baby steps of small change or change in a small scale. I think oftentimes in activism, the discourse tends to lean towards how to maximize impact. And I think it's very difficult to do both things, at least depending on the scale, of course, of the organization, but trying to maximize impact and also making, or by maximizing, meaning, you know, reaching the biggest number of people, but also being profound and meaningful impact, right? Maybe we can do a social media post that can reach 10,000 people in a few hours, but does that impact the same way as maybe having a personal in-person session with 50 people and every one of them leaves with lots of reflections and with a drive to think more or act more on what was discussed? So I do really believe that small impacts can make big changes. You know, I think one person is enough to start a whole chain of change. And so, yeah, so I'm really proud of the work that we have done over the years. I think I highlight two of our biggest, and in this case, they were ambitious projects. So they involved a bigger number of people, but it was always, again, focus on the local, right? We represented Lisbon as the chapter for the He for She movement. And so our focus was on our city. And we knew that if we did our work well there, we would have good impact and in good change for the future. So one of the projects was our academy. So we have the He for She Lisboa Academy, where we would provide a free of charge many weeks course on human rights. And this was in partnership with Nova University, so the School of Law from the new University of Lisbon. And it would be a deep dive into specifically the topic of human rights, from the most basic concepts to more specific ideas relating human rights with feminism, with gender equality. And we would give the opportunity for the participants to then, you know, shadow or do some small project in partner entities, be they companies, consulting firms, they could be foundations, NGOs that would collaborate with us, so that they could look into the aspects of what they were working on and try and implement something as well in that space. And it was always important for us to make all of our initiatives, and it's a commitment that we have as a chapter, but also as a movement, to make them free of charge, to allow people to access the resources and the events and the initiatives that we create without, you know, at least economical barriers, because we know that oftentimes there are many interesting things that may be happening in the civic society space that, you know, some people cannot access because they simply do not have the financial means to support it. So at least in that aspect, we made sure that we always made it free of charge. And we, of course, encourage everyone to apply and we give ample time to decide on who could participate with the application that we received. And the other project that we have is our We for Education, which was and is currently a project where a team from our movement goes into schools, so high schools, middle schools, primary schools, and teaches a variety of concepts from social justice and other things to the classes that wish to receive us in their school. And so depending on the age, depending on their interest, we would approach different subjects. We could talk about sexuality and complement, you know, the aspects of sexual education that sometimes might be not as strong in schools, or we can at least bring an angle of inclusive sexuality, understanding that sexuality isn't just the heterosexual sexuality that many schools teach. We could talk about, you know, simple concepts of differentiating gender and sex for younger audiences, or why equality is good. We could talk about gender stereotypes. We could talk about toxic masculinity, right? So we would curate the discussion that we would have depending on the interest of the classes, the teachers, the adequacy of whatever was considered best for them, to make sure that young kids had some exposure to these ideas. And again, starting from a young age, showing them this perspective. And indeed, we would feel it. So we had a team dedicated for this, but they, of course, also prepared in case of needing people to back them up or to replace them. Occasionally, they would prepare the sessions with some of us. And I went to a school very near to where I lived, and I contacted them in the class in person. And it was a really interesting experience. I mean, it's interesting not only because you are working with a younger audience than you usually work with in your events, and you have to learn to adapt and communicate the ideas in simpler ways so that they can understand. But it's also interesting understanding just, you know, sometimes we might be accustomed to the bubble where we live and to the people that we are surrounded with, and understanding how different perspectives are, or how people might not be informed about certain things. And so young kids, you know, explaining that, you know, it was very natural for them to expect a woman to stay at home and to do the chores and to take care of the household, while they would, you know, do, I mean, I refer here to young boys, but, you know, when they would grow up, they would, you know, become the breadwinner and become, you know, the head of household. And so starting from a young age, trying to tell them, you know, that's not fair for either of you. But, you know, you could see them, you know, having ideas, questioning what they were thinking. Other colleagues, especially of course, the girls, trying to show them that it isn't fair, and you know, creating interesting, sometimes chaotic discussion, but that would be very good for them to understand that, you know, the example that you have at home is not the extent of all the examples that may exist, and perhaps there are other ways of living that are fair and just for everyone.
Yeah, for sure, and especially if you start from a very young age already working with kids, so they can understand it's not how it has to be or it shouldn't be. So I think it's a very sustainable approach as well. And maybe because we are already at the 50-minute limit, kind of, maybe you can summarize the conversation a bit and say in a few words, how can we tackle toxic masculinity? Or, I mean, you already touched a lot of things, and how to promote positive masculinity.
Now the biggest challenge, which is asking me to summarize something, because... The 50-minute limit is clearly on my end being very extensive with my answers. How do we tackle all of this? I think, well, I would say for men that are starting to face themselves with these concepts, starting to think about it, in the process of not just activism, but just in general self-growth, there is always also an awkward phase. And this awkward phase is one where we feel strange. In some ways, we feel threatened because it is a discomfort, right? When we are learning to deconstruct something about ourselves, there is always a discomfort associated with it. And I think culturally, we are not taught in general, either men, women, whoever, we are not well taught to deal with this uncomfortable emotions and stay with them. So my first appeal is for us to learn to stay with our uncomfortable emotions and ask them and ask ourselves, why does that make me feel uncomfortable? Why can't I stay with it and slowly but surely understand what is the cause of it, right? Because our instinct is to, you know, skirt it off or dismiss it or be antagonistic against whatever is causing it, when instead we should perhaps ask, why does that make me feel uncomfortable, right? When we talk about, for example, I'm a queer person, and we talk about internalized homophobia, you know, again, when we bring about questions of masculinity and, you know, feminine traits and all of that, you know, there's a big part of, you know, the queer community, especially when it comes to gay men, that have very clear, I would call it a prejudice against other people, other men or male presenting people that express themselves in feminine ways. And in the past, I would consider that I myself had some feeling of discomfort in facing that. But, you know, the discomfort is a feeling that I have. It's not, it's a real feeling. It's not that feelings are not real, but it is not something that should condition the behavior of the person that, or whatever, is eliciting that feeling in me, right? It is something that I need to analyze first myself and understand why it is causing it. And if there is no validity to me feeling that way, why should I demand of other people to, you know, exist in a way that only makes myself feel comfortable, perhaps at the sacrifice of something on their end? So learning to be comfortable in the discomfort is the first step. Again, men have to, I'm now focusing on men because I think there needs to be a lot of work done internally for it to reflect on the outside. But I think they need to understand who their support networks are. I think they have to understand that, you know, if they have male friends, that they would perhaps be surprised at how willing other male friends are to sharing and expressing their emotions with them if only one of them starts. Oftentimes that is the challenge, right? There is this silent consensus around not really breaking the ice, but as soon as someone does it, it becomes very different. The nature of the relationship takes a completely different shape. And I think it's very important for men to be there for other men, and for, because they can become the example for other men, that they can be vulnerable, that they can be emotional, that they can share what they are feeling. They, you know, they have to listen to women. It's an old one, but it's a true one. I think women, if they are often on the receiving end of the consequences of toxic masculinity, I think they have to be open to understanding the perspective of women and how often men are blind, like all of us are. We have our own personal experiences and we are blind to the experiences of others because those questions never popped up in our heads. A very simple, almost mainstream pop feminism example, but you know, there was an interview on a British talk show with a bunch of actors and one actress, Saoirse Ronan. And there was a comment made on, I don't know, hiding someone's keys in their hand and being and using it as a weapon while on the street at night. And every man sort of laughed and dismissed the idea. And she very confidently and very simply said it, well, you laugh about it, but every woman here does it every night. Because again, she needed to bring to the spotlight the idea that, you know, what is a very basic, guaranteed right, let's say, for men, which is safety at night, is a constant fear and a real threat for many women also every night. So we need to understand that we live different worlds, but we can also prevent those worlds from being so different and so unfairly different. And what else could I say? I could say, yeah, I would encourage also the other side. I would encourage women to try and find ways of communicating with men that speaks more to their experience. I know that, you know, it's a touchy subject when we talk about feminism, trying to like, we shouldn't really need to pamper to men or to pamper and make other people comfortable when, you know, we know that deep down systemically, the roots of inequality stem primarily from men. I mean, it is an undeniable fact that we live in a misogynistic and male-centric society. So we don't need to really center men all the time to solve things. But I think it is fair on an individual level. At least I try to practice this individual with my friends. You know, I act with them as friends and as people that I care for. And I try to make them see things different ways. I try to understand as people, as someone that I know, as someone that has these particular characteristics, how can I make the question more obvious to you? How can I make it more digestible for you to understand it, but, you know, also not patronize you and, you know, try and teach it to you as a kid. It's a complex topic, and it's something that not only is important for you to learn, I would say that it is necessary for you to learn if you want to be someone that I really care for, because I care about these things, and I can't really, at least personally, relate to someone that wouldn't consider those things to be important as well. Bringing the importance of small acts of change, making big difference. We can't all be, you know, the Greta Thunbergs of the world creating massive climate protests, but we can't always be the friend to our circle that brings the question or that raises the interesting topic at the dinner table, or, you know, those small things that, you know, start the conversation and keep ideas rolling in people's heads.
Just thinking, like, the last points you mentioned, they sound doable and, like, not too difficult, but somehow it's, of course, a huge topic to address, but small step. Yep.
Yes. We all tend to be, or at least I myself know, I am an impatient person, and I really like to see change happening very quickly. But we also have to learn to understand that a lot of change sometimes is small. Sometimes there are big burst out moments in history where things change very drastically, but a lot of times things take time. We have to also be aware of that and comfortable with it. But I think the examples I give are small precisely because it's very easy, especially in our generations, we see a lot of that people become overwhelmed with so many crises that are happening around the world. So where to start? Well, you know, ignore all of the big things, focus on the small, focus on the local, focus on what you can actually do with more or less effort, but in a realistic setting.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. It's meaningful work, everything that you described. It might be slow, but it's a progress for sure. And I found this very motivating, and I hope other people who listen will find it motivating as well. Because as you say, some questions never popped into our head. So I hope that this will inspire some of those questions and thoughts so that they can think about this topic that is really important. And as we discussed, it impacts so much of our lives for all members of society, men, women, and the LGBT community as well. Do you have anything to say for the end?
I just wanted to thank you for the invitation. It was really lovely to have this conversation. I think I also benefit a lot from talking to other people about these things, because oftentimes it's when I discuss ideas with people that, you know, I start making connections in my mind about reflections that I've had in the past. So it's always good. And, you know, I think my final word would be to please, you know, support the ongoing movements for the liberation of the Palestinian people. Please support in any way we can. There are many fundraisers in many platforms, and it is important that we establish a path for peace in the current, again, poly-crisis world that we are facing. Yeah, thank you.
Inga, do you have anything to add?
No, thank you. I'm super happy with the conversation. It's super, very interesting to listen to you and get another perspective, as you said, and also the issue about toxic masculinity, about feminist movements is not an isolated one. And as you said, there we are in a poly crisis moment in the moment, or era in the moment. So it's really important to also see intersections of different crises.
Yeah. Yes, thank you for mentioning the other problem and reminding us how important it actually is, David. And thank you so much for this thought-provoking discussion today. And this brings us to the end of the episode. So for the listeners, we would love to hear your thoughts on this topic. So please leave a comment down below. And as always, thank you for listening to the Intersectionality Lab podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Intersectionality Lab. If some terms or topics made you curious, check out our website. Maybe some of the resources will keep your thoughts rolling. Meet us where the lines cross. We are a nonprofit research center working on human rights, gender equality, and active citizenship. And this podcast was created with the support of our team.